And tonight on Arena, we speak to Tom Sutherland, director of Titanic the Musical, and we preview Zoe Saldana, Nicole Kidman and Morgan Freeman in Special Ops Lioness. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Titanic and its sinking in 1912 on its maiden voyage has long been a source of fascination and inspiration for documentary makers, writers and filmmakers. A Night to Remember in 1958 was regarded as the definitive movie version until along came James Cameron in 1997 with his own film version simply called Titanic. In that same year, a musical version, this is 1997, of the Titanic story came to Broadway. It ran for 2 years, 804 performances, and cleaned up at the Tony Awards. Now, Titanic the Musical comes to Dublin. I'm delighted to be joined by its director, Tom Sutherland. This 1997 stage musical version, first of all, Tom, how did you come across it?
It's quite an interesting story. I happened to be in New York sort of many years later, sort of 2003, and I happened across an old sort of souvenir shop that was closing down, and they were selling off lots of old sort of souvenir brochures, you know, the sort of programs that you get with all the pictures of. And I reached through the box and I found one of this, what seemed like an epic musical, a version of Titanic. And I flicked through this souvenir brochure and thought, this is the most incredible piece of theatre, and I looked at the images, and as somebody that has always been interested in the Titanic story, I bought this souvenir brochure for a couple of dollars and took it home, and then bought the CD and listened to the music and thought, I have to bring this to the stage for audiences sort of across in Europe, because the show had never ever come this over the side of the Atlantic. I thought it was appropriate to sort of bring the story of the Titanic home.
And interestingly enough, I mean, the thoughts for many people, there was a huge debate on this station, in fact, some time back in recent weeks, around the whole idea of that term, those words together, Titanic the Musical. People were, some people were very wary of the whole idea of commemorating something so tragic. I mean, let's face it, it was one of the great tragedies of the 20th century. Did you have any of those qualms yourself?
Of course. I mean, I think that sometimes revolves around what we expect a musical to be and what a musical to do. But I think the nature of the score written by Maury Yeston and the story, which is all drawn from factual events that was put together by Peter Stone, one of the greatest book writers and sort of film writers of his time. This really is a tribute, an homage to the people who built and sailed in Titanic, rather than a fascination, a morbid fascination with the sort of the tragic end of what happened to Titanic. This musical really is a celebration of life and hopes and dreams and aspirations of what Titanic should have been.
So this original version then, this 1997 musical, does it deal with real passengers? Is it the story of actual people who sailed on that tragic maiden voyage?
So everybody that we depict on stage is, everybody's name is taken from the passengers or crew list. And even there, we deal with the designers and the builders of the ship as well. And nothing is fabricated. We only deal with the real events and the true story and the people who sailed and crewed the greatest ocean liner of her time.
So is it pretty much what was in that original script and that original libretto? Have you stuck with that or have you changed much?
There were some changes that were done because the show, of course, was originally written for American audiences. And there were some tweaks and changes that were done, including the sort of the whole nature of the show. When we brought it originally to London, where we premiered the show nearly 10 years ago, we changed some sections of it, but it still is very much that grand Broadway musical. It's in all respects, it's a large musical, as fitting to the largest ship.
Yeah, I suppose. And you need a big stage to do that, which is why it's at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre here in Dublin. Let's have a listen to a section from the prologue sung by Mr. Andrews. Mr. Andrews is the shipbuilder, isn't he? He was on the ship on that maiden voyage. Is that who's singing this prologue? Or that's the character?
Yeah, that's it. Thomas Andrews, who was, of course, the designer of the Titanic and who dreamt one day of designing and building the largest moving object in the world.
Right, well, let's have a listen to a little section of the prologue then, sung by that Mr. Andrews from Titanic the Musical. There we go. That's the voice of Mr. Andrews, the designer of the Titanic from Titanic the Musical. And this is from the London production of the show. And with me this evening is Tom Sutherland, director of the production, which is coming to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. It's interesting what he speaks of within that song, Tom. You know, in every age, man tries to complete some amazing feat. But there's a little bit of hubris in there, I would have thought, comparing what they're doing to Stonehenge, to the Parthenon, to the aqueducts of Rome.
Well, it's the Bruce Ismay, who was the owner at the time of the White Star Line, when he announced these three huge ocean liners, he called them the conquerors of Poseidon, and he wanted to put out his claim to say that this was not just a ship, this would be a legend. And he always said that he wanted, when he was creating Titanic and her sister ships, he wanted to create a legend of the largest and the grandest moving objects in the world. And sort of rather ironically, he got his legend in the end.
Yeah, but does that hubris, is that played out in this story, or is it, as you suggested to me in your opening remarks, is it effectively a celebration of this attempt to create, you know, achieve one of the great feats of human industry in the early part of the 20th century?
I think we both, I suppose. We have to celebrate the feat that it was to build and create something so majestic and so incredible of its time. And for all of the passengers that sailed on the Titanic, she was not just a ship that was just going to another country. This was a ship that was taking the hopes and dreams of many immigrants to the new and promised land. I think that also is sort of the boat sort of lends itself to being so poetic, and it was originally written about in such legendary terms. I think that's the nature of what the musical sort of tells, rather than a romantic love story that James Cameron's put on.
Are Rose and Jack there, by the way? Is there any Rose or Jack?
Jack and Rose are on a different part of the ship. We don't focus on them.
they don't come on stage for this little bit.
Not this one.
Yeah,
not
they're too busy. One. They're too busy up in the first class restaurant, clearly, to be bothered with you guys. Let's have a listen to some of the characters who are heading on to the ship. And this I find actually quite touching, just the names of the people, the way they sing to each other. And of course, it was built in Belfast, and it did set off on its Atlantic set part of the voyage from Cove in Cork. And obviously that is a big part of the story. And it's certainly there in the passenger list, as we'll hear in this song. Oh, there you go. Not one, not two, but three kits all boarding in Cove. And I suppose that Irish angle of it is there. And as you mentioned, Tom Sutherland, director of Titanic the Musical, which is coming to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre, speaking with me this evening. That song goes on to explain, really, they are from a different class from those who would be up in first class with Jack and Rose from the film. These are the ordinary folk, I suppose, who were going off in search of a better life for themselves. And that is part of the real tragedy of Titanic. How is that? I suppose we get to know these people. Do we get to, how do you treat the loss of these people as well as, you know, the dreams that they express early on, Tom?
Well, I think it is about their hopes and dreams. And that song goes on. And Kate McGowan, she sings, "Let all our children's children know that this day long ago we dreamt of them." And it's sort of when we bring the show back to Dublin, it's sort of, I know it's going to have such a resonance with the people that are there in that audience, because we are their children. We are the people who are the ancestors of the people who built and sailed in the ship. So as...
Well, I suppose those who survived the journey.
That's it. But also the people, the children and the families who were left behind of people who sailed and tragically lost their lives. But it's when that tragic moment happens, it's sort of the ship hits the iceberg just before the interval, and in the second act of the show takes a very different tone. And instead of sort of trying to replicate history, we all know from the various movies and the documentaries the specifics of what happened. We now just see the tragedy of human separation and what happens when we are faced with this terrible event and the certainty of maybe the end of your life. Mm. What happens then, and how we commemorate and celebrate those people who stayed behind, and the legacy of those people who got off, were fortunate enough to get off the boat into a lifeboat, and spent the rest of their lives remembering and commemorating what happened that evening.
What would you say to those perhaps who do are of the feeling that, you know, Titanic the musical is in and of itself is just a bad idea? How would you persuade them that perhaps this show addresses those difficulties, and how does the show address them?
I think we have everybody who lost their lives that evening in April 1912. Their names appear on our stage, and there is a moment in our show where the entire cast turn and face them and remember and sort of tell us what we can learn from this tragedy and from this tragic event. And it is a human story of loss, but also, very strangely, it's a celebration of humanity and what humanity can do, and the relationships that were actually made stronger by the events of that evening. There is many things that have happened in maritime and history and maritime sort of logistics that would never have happened unless that fateful voyage had happened then. So it isn't all doom and gloom, though. It is for two-thirds of the show, we are presented with we tell the story of 2,300 people who were setting off for the most exciting adventure of their life. Nice. It's only the end of it which is the tragedy. But also it's so excellently written that you can't help but sort of remember and celebrate them.
I suppose that simple roll call is a way of commemorating those people with respect, which I guess was your plan in doing so, and the plan of the show.
Absolutely. I think it's a tribute to them, and we honour them on stage.
Tom, thanks for speaking with us this evening. That's Tom Sutherland, director of Titanic the Musical, which will run for 9 performances only at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in Dublin between August the 1st and August the 5th. And you can find out full details of tickets and how to get them on boardgoshenergytheatre.ie. Yes, indeed, John will be directly after us this evening. Special Ops Lioness is a new espionage drama starring Zoe Saldana, Nicole Kidman and Morgan Freeman. This 8-part miniseries is based on the Lioness Engagement Teams, a real-life US military program that uses female personnel. This fictional unit aims to infiltrate terrorist groups to gather information on its targets by forming relationships with wives, girlfriends and daughters. Zoe Saldana plays Jo, who, as well as having a complicated personal life, is in charge of the squad that she must recruit, train and manage. Dave Hanratty has been watching the series for us, or at least the first 2 episodes, I think, is all we were given, Dave. He's with me in studio now. It is a kind of a fascinating and disturbing premise, this, but it has a very strong basis in reality.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of that has carried over to the show itself, because this is very Pulp Fiction, you know, it's very kind of familiar in that regard. It's a hell of an idea, though, and I guess it makes sense. I mean, like, you know, we are kind of in the summer of films like Mission Impossible and so on, so spycraft and that kind of thing is quite interesting to see, I guess, in the show from a military perspective. And it is kind of disturbing as well, like it's very, very dark, this show. I mean, like, you might anticipate some lightness to that premise, but no, not at all, not here.
Yeah, because, I mean, the opening section is the loss of one of these, and I'm giving nothing away saying that, the loss of one of these personnel in a very difficult situation. Where she, basically her cover is blown, and therefore they have to make a choice as to what do they do here? Do they blow the place up, or do they try to rescue her? What's the plan? It's nail-biting stuff for that first 2 or 3 minutes.
You have to start shows out this way, like a new thing. Like you have to get the viewer's attention immediately, because, of course, we live in this age where there are so many entertainment options that if you don't come out of the tracks with something bombastic in this regard, yeah, and in that regard, it is a bit of a... It's a decent hook. Zoe Saldana plays our kind of main character here, Jo, and she's the character who is tasked with making that impossible decision, a decision that she will then be scrutinized over by her bosses, but she maintains that there was no other way to go. And so, yeah, I mean, like, it will grab your attention, but kind of keep your attention as the show continues on. That's the real question here, I think.
Yeah, because that's quickly we move on from that to the story of the recruiting of another of these young women, a character of Cruz played by Olivia
Leila de Oliveira.
Leila de Oliveira. We see her backstory, which is very disturbing.
Extremely dark and nasty, yeah. And like this is not a show for all the family. She plays this woman who is clearly in the throes of a domestic violence situation, a life that she's desperate to escape. And essentially what happens is she has enough one day, turns on her abusive boyfriend and finds herself running for her life, literally running for her life out in the streets. No one's helping her. And she stumbles, like, she's trying all these doors. They're not opening. All these shops are closed. Nobody will let her in. And finally, she manages to get into this place.
Yeah, you have a place which has a marine inside. And here's the scene when she gets in the door with the violent boyfriend stroke partner pursuing her.
Somebody help!
Problems between me and her.
Not anymore. Now it's between you and the United States Marines. Life boils down to a few decisions. You're now facing one of them. You okay?
Thanks.
You did that to his face?
I cheated. I used a frying pan.
In war, if you aren't cheating, you aren't trying.
I've been at war my whole life, Ben.
Well... You came to the right place.
In war, you ain't treating if you ain't trying. You
know,
it's one of the things, and certainly the opening episode that I saw. That's one of the opening early scenes from Special Ops Lioness that Dave Hanratty has been watching for us. Leila de Oliveira, who will become a vitally important character later into the series, finding herself there, being rescued by the Marine. A couple of disturbing things about it, this idea that, you know, the rescuing Marine is the all-powerful, it's the great. There's no question about what he's doing elsewhere or what the Marines are doing elsewhere. And the language is real gung-ho there. I mean, does it keep at that kind of level?
Oh, yeah. This is ridiculous. Like, that was 13 minutes into the first episode. And I'm really glad that you chose that clip, because when that happened, in that moment where the boyfriend's like, problems between me and her, and the Marine's like... It's between you and the US Marines now, son. You know, it's just like, okay, cool, this is what we're doing. Like, I rolled my eyes so far in the back of my head that I could almost see my brain. I mean, it's just like, this is Purple Prose. It's everyone speaks like this. They all speak in cliche, kind of, you know, huge, tough talk. And that's pretty much everybody. Like, everyone's just kind of in that vein. And yes, there's no question here. The Marines are the good guys. And this felt like a recruitment campaign. The show feels like it paints, you know, this very attractive life for you, because this character, the character of Cruz, this lady in question, there's no question that she will then, of course, go back to that recruitment office and sign up. She does. This isn't a spoiler.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the series is based on.
And if you've seen anything, you know that's what's going to happen, because one guy showed her kindness. And essentially it's like, someone's like, are you ready to leave your life behind? And she's like, I have no life.
Yeah.
This is the life now. And it's just really jingoistic in that way and just very cartoonish. You know?
The problem is that jingoism and that jingoistic nature and that cartoonish quality. I mean, it seems as if you're from the Middle East, being blown up and being killed is irrelevant. But if you're an American in trouble at all, that's hugely important. I mean, it is disturbing in many ways.
It won't be for everybody, though. And I got to wonder what the demographic will be. You know, in certain kind of parts of America may well, you know, take to this, like, with a great sense of pride, perhaps. Mm. Others might be repulsed by it. And we should say, like, you mentioned that opening scene, that it is disturbing, and you do see someone meet their end on an operation, and it's not a nice thing. But it does feel very kind of hoorah. Like, it does feel very kind of, you know, gung-ho. That was another word that he used, very pro-America. You know, it makes it, like, it's both simultaneously glamorous in one sense, but also not in another, because, like, these characters will also go through the mill physically and be on the receiving end of vicious beatings and all kinds of, you know, physical trauma. But I just felt that this was like we talked about a show last year called The Terminal List, that Chris Pratt show.
Mm.
Similar kind of thing. It feels a bit video gamey to me, but I know that the people who will watch this and will be attracted by it.
Is there any nuance then? I mean, when you look down, the cast, it's Zoe Saldana, Morgan Freeman I mentioned is in there, Nicole Kidman is in there as well. Is there any nuance in how they treat the politics of the situation, or does it remain America good, everybody else bad?
Pretty much so far from what I've seen, it is America good, everybody else bad. I mean, there's a level of bureaucracy in here. So Nicole Kidman's character, who's not in it that much, you know, she's all over the promotional materials.
I think she's an executive producer as well, isn't she?
And so is Zoe Saldana as well. And I mean, like, she's essentially a higher up who will confront Zoe Saldana over the operation and why it failed and what went wrong and blah, 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 blah. But it's more a case of, you know, saying to her that she messed up on an individual level, as opposed, you know, it's very much like we are the CIA. The Zoe Saldana character is described as like the tip of the spear in the war on terror. And it's about, you know, getting the job done by any means necessary, going to those ugly places you have to. So far, not really anyone kind of questioning any of this. It's just very, like, you use the word nuance. The word nuance was clearly left outside the writing room door.
Yeah. What about the relationship that builds then between the Zoe Saldana character, who is an operative? She's in the field with these young women who are befriending whoever the wives and girlfriends of people they believe are America's enemy, numbers 1 to 10 type of thing. What about the relationship that builds between Zoe Saldana's character and Leila de Oliveira character, the woman who is recruited?
Yeah, so combative, I would say, because obviously Zoe Saldana needs a new member on her team based on what happens in the opening minutes of the show. And like we say, it's pretty clear who that's going to be. And so these two kind of come together. So you got this one character in Zoe Saldana who's very kind of steely. You know, she's kind of battle hardened and world weary and an amazing military tactician and a specialist, with this new, much more kind of rough around the edges, raw character who has all these physical gifts. You know, like this Cruise character aces her training, aces the men's training. They've never seen a recruit like this before. She's incredible, but mentally, maybe she's not quite there. So they have this kind of, not quite good cop, bad cop thing going on, but they're at each other's throats to a degree, but there's clearly a level of, like, this will build and they'll somehow bring out the best in each other. But it's hard-jawed stuff, you know, like everyone's kind of glaring at each other, all that kind of stuff. There's not a lot of levity here.
Yeah, and as we've only seen, you've only seen two episodes, I've only seen one of the episodes, the violence, I presume, continues at a pretty high level, not only on the battlefield, but the kind of psychological violence, the kind of recruitment regime that these people are put through, the physical tasks that they're put through, the physical punishments if they don't complete a task. Does that kind of psychological and horrific type of terror violence, does that continue?
The second episode is pretty much entirely based around that, and it's horrendous. Like, I don't want to give away spoilers here necessarily, but like, it involves one of our main characters being put through the ringer in that fashion, to the point where, you know, one character's like, you know, she has to be tested. I have to know, you know, what her limits are, when she'll break. And you got other characters being like, this is too much. And as a viewer, I thought it was too much. I was just kind of like, this feels like I'm watching Zero Dark Thirty again. But Zero Dark Thirty is an amazing film with a lot of nuance, a lot of kind of difficult questions being asked. And you can take away from it and say, like, should they have filmed this? Well, I don't know. You can have interesting conversations about it. But this is just really kind of, like, I used the word cartoonish earlier on, but it just felt really self-indulgent and not It didn't feel protective of what the characters should be. It felt really kind of exploitative at times.
So you don't care about the characters ultimately? Is that the way it feels?
They're not really characters. They're more kind of archetypes. Mm. Now, I think Zoe Saldana is very, very good in this in particular. She's a great actor and a box office draw, and she can do quiet emotion well, but they're just playing these kind of action figures, really.
It's not a ringing endorsement, I don't think, from you tonight, Dave, is it?
I didn't hate it. Put that on the poster, but like, I've seen this stuff before, and I know where it's going, and it doesn't have a lot on its mind. And I wonder why Taylor Sheridan, who's the creator of the show, he wrote Sicario, he wrote Hell or High Water, he wrote Wind River. I don't know what he's doing here. He's the guy behind Yellowstone. He's a huge TV guy now at the moment. This felt like he wrote it over the course of one or two weekends, and it's enough to just upload in a streaming service. Some people will like it. Just feels really disposable to me.
All right. Doesn't sound, as I say, like a ringing endorsement from you. That's Dave Hanratty speaking to us about Special Ops Lioness, which is on Paramount Plus. The first two episodes are available right now, and there will be new episodes then every Sunday. Now, we spent the last couple of nights, of course, on the programme in Galway at the International Arts Festival, which continues its run through until the 30th. We are visiting Galway once again on Thursday, this coming Thursday, the July the 27th. An audience with Druid Theatre Company at the Town Hall Theatre, and this is celebrating their production of Druid O'Casey. Saw the trilogy while we were in Galway, and very, really much looking forward to speaking to some of the cast and indeed the crew, the creatives around this particular production. On Thursday, July the 27th, 3 p.m. in the Town Hall Theatre, we will be joined by the creative team behind Druid O'Casey, including director Gary Hines. Some of the cast will be there as well: Marty Ray, Rory Nolan, Hilda Faye, Zara Devlin, and a host of others as well. I'll chat to them about the whole process behind making this a very impressive production indeed, and you could be part of it. If you want to be there, you have to go to druid.ie. It'll happen between 3 and 4 p.m. Next Thursday, but go to the Druid website to find out about this special. Arena, Druid O'Casey from the Town Hall Theatre Galway, July the 27th, 3 to 4pm, druid.ie for full details. We stay in Galway. In 2021, Megan Nolan made her name as a gifted author with her first novel, Acts of Desperation, the tale of a young woman's difficult romance set in the Dublin art scene. Now the Waterford-born London-based writer is back with her second book, Ordinary Human Failings. It opens in 1990 in London on a council estate where a toddler has just been found dead. Before long, suspicion falls on the Greens, a troubled Irish family, and in particular 10-year-old Lucy. Adele Coffey has been reading the novel for us, and she is in our Galway studio on this Monday evening. Adele, I suppose Ordinary Human Feelings, I'm talking about it marking a departure for Megan Nolan, but I'm talking generally in terms of her first book, The Acts of Desperation, which really had a very strong vein of auto-fiction within it. Are we in a totally different world here? Is it a total departure for Megan Nolan?
Yeah, I think it is. Like, there are elements here which we'll get to. But yes, it is a departure in that it is her second novel. It is an ensemble novel, multiple characters, multiple points of view. And it's set in 1990, which is the year that Megan Nolan was born. Whereas previously we had a very contemporary novel for her debut, Acts of Desperation. Because she had written so much personal essay and columns before that book was published, people had an idea of her own life and her own experience. And it was undeniable in a way that there were elements of autofiction in that book. In this book, I do think that she has a biographical autobiography, certain experiences that she's written about in those personal essays. I couldn't help add that layer to reading this book. Yeah. For example, Carmel, as a teenager, has a relationship with a man who's much older than her. He's in his 20s, and she becomes pregnant, and she does not want to be pregnant. And Nolan has written about her own teen pregnancy, that she then went and had an abortion, and the difficulties around that experience. And so reading those scenes in the book, it's hard not to sort of layer that over it. And she, obviously, that biographical authority must come into the authenticity of how she describes that particular scene.
Even though these are fictionalized characters and fictionalized scenes, you see the parallels within, particularly because so much of it is there in the personal essays. You mentioned Carmel there. Give us a little bit of detail of this Green family and how they end up in London. It's a very, I don't know how to describe it as a family unit. It's quite a, quite an interesting one from a fiction point of view. We'd call it
blended, I think, these days. But back where it starts with Carmel sort of in 1978 and 1980, they move to London, the whole family, because she denies that she's pregnant for so long that she essentially leaves it too late to get an abortion. So when her mother brings her over at 5 months pregnant, she's told she can't have an abortion. And so the mother just decides to bring her husband and her stepson, Richard, who is the husband's son from a previous marriage. And we find out all about that marriage through the different perspectives. It's so complex and so interesting. Mm. But when you're reading it, it doesn't feel complicated. It feels straightforward. It feels fluid. But yes, they are this complicated family unit. And Rose, who is Carmel's mother, acts as the mother of the child, as so often happened in Ireland in those times when a young girl had a baby. The grandmother essentially took over the rearing of that child. But what Nolan is looking at in that experience is Carmel's absolute repulsion and revulsion about being pregnant, yeah, about having a child and not wanting to. And a lot of that experience is actually at the heart of this book when we meet John, the husband's first wife. She is a woman. And I think Nolan is writing about women who are warped by that pressure, that demand that we behave a certain way, that we have children, that we love children, that we sacrifice ourselves for children, or that if we do find ourselves unexpectedly pregnant, we accept our fate and we lie down and we sacrifice our lives. Yeah, and how that warps women's lives and their outlook.
That whole theme of unwanted and unplanned parenthood, it's a very strong theme across several of the characters, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and across the whole story, really, that theme of abandonment, of responsibility, these ordinary human failings, the sense of just complete lack of responsibility, and how that in itself comes from, you know, that responsibility foisted upon people, you know, when they have no agency, they have no option, they have no choice. So they're in this situation they don't want to be in, and they sort of shirk that responsibility, or they're rejected, or they're just not able for it. So that's a huge theme in the book, and how the children are just left. It begins with Lucy, who's off out playing with the group of kids, and nobody really knows what's happened.
She's one of the Green family, isn't she, Lucy?
Yeah, yeah. She's the unwanted child. Yeah. So she's off out playing because obviously that's preferable for her mother, and she gets to sort of stay in her own world then. But because she's neglected so much, nobody really knows what she's at, what she's doing, and nobody really knows what's happened. And so the book kind of has a mystery element to it, because it begins and we don't really know who's killed the child. We don't really know what's happened. Was it an accident? Was it a murder? So it has that sort of element of a crime, sort of mystery novel almost to it. And that gives it really good pacing, because you don't really know until the end what
actually
happened.
Yeah, but I mean, a novel that opens with the death of a child, that's a very bleak scenario.
She deals with it very well, actually. She doesn't go into too much detail, and it's kind of, you know, it's dealt with very sensitively. It's kept off the page a lot. And the book, I would say, is not even about the death of a child. I think the death of the child is there to sort of be the worst possible outcome result of these things we were talking about earlier, like forcing women into situations that they don't want to be in and that they should have a choice about. And I think that is her point with this book, actually.
So, but that the death of that child is one of the aspects that kind of, I suppose, is one of the engines that drives the early part of the book, particularly in and around a journalist character called Tom Hargreaves, who sees the potential of that story, which again has a kind of a horrible feeling to it, but that story might be big career move for him
disgusting character.
Yeah.
He's such a revolting, nasty, nasty character, to the extent that I felt this guy is almost cartoonishly villainous. And then I sort of thought back, 90s, Fleet Street, and even the noughties, what came after that with all the phone hacking scandals. He might be cartoonishly villainous, but he's absolutely plausible, because all of this stuff was how journalists thought then and possibly still think now. Completely unethical. He comes across the death of the toddler when he's going home to sleep with this woman who lives in the council estate, and he acts all sort of benevolent and says he wants to help out, when really what he wants to do is get access to the family and to find out what's going on and get a scoop for himself. So he takes the family away, puts them up in a little hotel and says, well, we'll pay for everything, drink yourself silly, because he knows that if he gets them drunk, they might say something silly and revealing, and it will be good for him. So he's really a noxious kind of odious character.
But is he believable within all of that? You know, does he become too cartoonish?
Well, like for me, maybe I was being sensitive because I am a journalist, and I feel like God, I'd like that. But he is the worst of the worst, and I think he is plausible, because I did actually question this. I thought, is he too much? But I think he is plausible. Really, he's just, I don't want to believe him because he's so unethical. He's so awful. But he is representative of certain tabloid journalists, and you know, we know these. This is how tabloid journalists have behaved, and worse, actually.
The Greens are an Irish family who have come to England, and I suppose were in Ireland in the late 70s, then in England in the early 80s when they first get there, and then the present day moment of the book is the London of the 1990s. Being an Irish family on this council estate, how do they fit in or not fit in, as the case may be, with that background to cope with their own Irishness to cope with?
Yeah, I really like this element of the book, actually, because how they left Waterford. There was never any plan to leave their home of Waterford, but because of how they left, which was the mother and the pregnant daughter went ahead to get an abortion, and when that failed, the mother sent word home to say, look, we're all just going to move here. And because of that, you know, you've got this father who was older than the mother by some amount of years. You've got this older stepson who's struggling with alcoholism, and taken out of their home scenario, however bad it was, at least they had community, they had friends, they had people who knew them. And then they went into the situation of London in 1990, which was kind of, you know, if you think about the IRA back then, their campaign was pretty strong. Margaret Thatcher was still in power, I think. It wouldn't have been a good time, but she really describes that alienation that they feel, and the sort of isolation that is, I think, foisted upon them. People stay away from them. People are suspicious of them. And I think, you know, we see that a lot in the present day in our own country with immigrants coming here, that sort of keeping people apart from, you know, from the people who are from Ireland, or the same with London, the people who are from there. And she also goes into this idea of good people and bad people. You know, the family of the child who is killed, they happen to be, you know, the father is a community leader, and they're just really good, decent people. And of course, then we have the family of the Greens who are, you know, they're ne'er-do-wells, they don't work, they're, you know, that parasitic kind of reputation for leeching off social welfare. So she's really holding up all these prejudices we might have against people, and, you know, how we judge them based on what they do. And as we all know, you know, good people can do bad things too.
Of course. The other thing is, I suppose, the idea or the themes of alcoholism and unwanted pregnancy are hardly new to Irish literature, indeed to any Irish story that's told, particularly if it's in, you know, contemporary or 20th century, as this particular story is. Has Megan Nolan done something new with those themes? Has she presented them to us in a different way?
You know, she has. And, you know, when you hear about a novel that is describing those things or about those things, alcoholism, the Catholic influence, abortion, lack of abortion, you know, there's part of you that just thinks, yes, we know this. And she has admitted herself, these are cliched Irishisms. However, it's a testament to her writing that she has managed to make this a kind of like an emotionally riveting read. Her characters, when she goes into their backstory, the backstory of each character is, it's so upsetting. You're just so 100% invested in them. And that's, I think, where her real talent comes out, in this kind of deep psychological analysis of human beings. And you believe all of her characters, because you feel so sorry for all of them.
Yeah, I think that structural aspect of the novel, the fact that we're going across several timelines in doing so, but that we do get the points of view of several different characters, I think that was one of the things that really sold the novel for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Because when I started reading, I didn't really know what it was going to be. It starts with the journalist and in the modern day. And I was thinking, okay, are we just going to hear about what happened up to this point? But actually, no, she goes back into each individual character and into their voice. And so that sort of first person point of view for each character really makes us empathize with them in a huge way. And they're, like the brother, the alcoholic brother, his story is so tragic. And there's a scene where you just, you know what's coming. You want to climb into the page and you want to scream and you want to say, please don't. Yeah. And of course he does.
Yeah, so it's very well handled. This sounds like, despite the seeming bleakness of the tale, this sounds like a very strong recommendation from you.
Yeah, and I think it would be brilliant for book clubs. If you're looking for something juicy to discuss, there's loads of brilliant themes here. Mm. But yes, it's hard to say I recommend this really sad, depressing book, but I heartily recommend it because the characters are so strong and it's such an emotional read. Like, it is, it's impossible not to finish it and not to love each character, even though they're all really difficult, sad characters.
Right. Okay, it sounds like a one to put on the book list or the reading list for sure. That's Adele Coffey speaking to us about Megan Nolan's latest novel, Ordinary Human Failings, which is published by Jonathan Cape. Now, until very recently, whenever we went to the cinema or turned on the television, all our attention was focused on the screen, not what went on behind that screen to deliver the entertainment. But in recent weeks, with Hollywood's writers and actors going out on strike, the public are waking up to the fact that Tinseltown isn't all luxury and glamour. It's very hard work for a very select few who are not necessarily that well paid. Joining us to discuss the history of labour in Hollywood is Stephen Benedict. And to put our discussion in focus, let's begin with a clip from a film made over 30 years ago, Robert Altman's The Player, a satire on the movie industry, which went behind the scenes in a fictitious Hollywood studio to reveal the working practices of one of its executives, Griffin Mill, played by Tim Robbins.
Hello, sorry I'm late. Griffin, you missed the formal welcoming ceremony this morning. You know Larry Levy.
Of course. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Griffin.
Larry was able to get out of Fox a week earlier than he thought and has come aboard as of this morning.
Great. Let's start.
In fact, Larry was just in the middle of something.
Oh, no, I wasn't. I was just killing time waiting for Griffin.
Oh. Well, no, finish. What were you saying?
I was just saying that I've yet to meet a writer who could change water into wine, and we have a tendency to treat them like that. But all I'm saying is I think there's a lot of time and money to be saved if we came up with these stories on our own.
I was just thinking what an interesting concept it is to eliminate the writer from the artistic process. If we can just get rid of these actors and directors, maybe we got something here.
Tim Robbins there in The Player, Robert Altman's Oscar-nominated satire on the movie industry, joining us this evening to discuss the history of the relationship writers, actors and directors have had with the studios of Stephen Benedict. It's extraordinary when you hear that scene, Stephen. Let's get rid of the writers. Sure, if we can get rid of the actors and everybody else, we'll be fine.
Yeah, the great thing about the scene there is a breakfast meeting between the executives. And the thing is, the night before, Tim Robbins's character, Griffin Mill, has actually murdered a writer.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very appropriate allegory for what's happening now, you know, because I think the strange thing about Hollywood is that it has no unions. I say that very carefully. It has guilds.
Yes.
The Screenwriters Guild, the Directors Guild.
And I suppose just to give that context, the reason for the current strike and that the actors have joined in is this idea that AI, in fact, might replace the writers and the actors.
That's precisely it. You know, so their livelihoods are going to be given up. And, it's, you know, we can go back into the history of Hollywood and see that the problems that they're experiencing now, actually the seeds were sown way, way back in the early days. The difference between the union and the guild is enormous, but it's subtle. The reason why they're called guilds is because back in the early days, by which I mean the 1910s, the filmmaking process had not yet been industrialised. And the industrialisation of filmmaking, that brought in the need for workers' rights. And that really didn't happen until the 1920s, when cinema moved from being an attraction to being an industry. Mm. And in that transition, it needed the backing of Wall Street. It needed investment. Until then, there were really small companies that are yet to transform into even smaller or even the bigger studios. But back then, management was incredibly hostile towards workers, and they could afford to be, because it wasn't until 1935 that the workers' rights was finally enshrined into the US law.
Right.
Okay, with the National Labour Relations, 1935. Until then, if you uttered the word union, you were running the strong risk of being branded a communist.
And that's why we have Screen Actors Guild, and they're all referred
they're
to
not
as
unions.
Guilds. Yeah, yeah. It's a subtle difference, as you say. But you talked about the 1920s there, and nothing happened until 1935. But of course, if you think the 1940s then, when the whole House Un-American Activities Committee was in action, and the whole question of if you were anything remotely left-leaning, you got the label of communist and you were blacklisted immediately.
And then, you know, those writers and directors and filmmakers would have been, may have flirted with communism back in the 1920s, but backed away. And so we've got to remember, you know, the entertainment ecology was incredibly fraught from the very, very start. Los Angeles really only emerged as the filmmaking center because of two things, the weather, the climate, and the low wages. But the thing was that the lifeline for those companies was investment. And the big banks were way back, far back in the East, in New York. And to give an example of how tenuous that was, in 1911, there was a gentleman called Alan Dwan, and he was based in Chicago, and he was an electrical engineer working for a company. And he was sent out to Los Angeles to figure out where on earth this film company had vanished to, because they had no communications and no wires, nothing coming through from them. And he finally tracked down the company, and he realized that the reason why they hadn't been filming is because the director had gone off on a drinking binge. So he wires back to Chicago and advises them to shut down the company, disband them. Chicago wired back and said, no, you take up the reins of director and finish the film. And that is how Alan Dwan became a film director. And for the next 50 years, he directed 125 movies. Wow. So the early days of Hollywood was complete chaos.
The jazz singer, though, which would have been, I suppose, the beginning of the talkies, that was a very significant moment in this respect and in terms of this story of labour relations.
You're actually right. I mean, the jazz singer is a game changer. But in terms of our discussion here, I think it happened around 20 years earlier, around 1907, 1908. Mm. Because what happened was audiences then were no longer satisfied with one-reeler films, which amounted to 12 minutes of entertainment. Their appetite was not being satisfied, so they wanted longer stories.
Yeah.
So longer stories meant... Longer stories meant more filming. More filming meant more labour, which meant more costs, which meant more investment, which meant more organisation, which also meant the standardisation of the production and standardising. And that's when it started to become an industry.
Yeah, so you're talking about people with different roles.
Exactly.
And very stratified roles.
Set construction.
Demarcated roles.
Exactly. Production, costume designers. But as I said to you, it wasn't in 1935 that the workers' rights were enshrined into law. But for me, I think the real damage occurred back in the 1920s, a decade earlier, because that's when the fledgling studios went to Wall Street for investment. Mm. And until then, it's very, very important, women played a very prominent role in Hollywood. For example, in 1922, there was a lady called June Mathis, and she was the highest paid executive in Hollywood in 1922. It was she who discovered Rudolph Valentino, who then went on to become one of the biggest stars in the silent era. Another lady by the name of Anita Loose, she was most famous for having written Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. In 1912, she was the first commissioned female screenwriter in Hollywood. In 1912.
Wow.
Okay, and another one, Frances Marion. In 1933, she was the first woman to win the Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay. But what happened was, with the investment from Wall Street, the women were nudged out because the old money boys did not want these young women playing with the toys.
Yeah.
So I mentioned that because the writers, it's not just about residuals, it's not about money, it's about equality and it's about dignity.
Let's listen to a clip from one of the great films about the whole union story. This is Norma Rae starring Sally Field in the title role here. Performance, in fact, that won her an Oscar. She plays a factory worker here with three children campaigning to form a union.
I want this church for a union meeting next Saturday afternoon. That's blacks and whites sitting together.
This is a house of God.
That's what I'm waiting to see, whether it is or whether it isn't.
You're coming mighty close to blasphemy, Norma.
I've come here and said I sinned and I done wrong and I'm sorry and I ask for God to forgive me. Now I want to see what this church stands for. I want to see if you'll stand up in that pulpit and say there ought to be justice, there ought to be a union. And if you're smitten and you rise up and the Lord will be on your side. And if you don't, and I say there ain't nothing good for me in that church, and I'm going to leave it flat.
We're going to miss your voice in the choir, Norma.
You're going to hear it raised up someplace else.
There you go. Sally Field in her Oscar-winning performance as Norma Rae, title role in that film about a cotton mill worker who forms a union for better working conditions. And again, this is leading us into the reasons why many of the actors are on strike. Now, I love the line that she has in that. We're going to find out if it's God's house or not. But it's this... These lifelike characters that, you know, people we know and love, Cillian Murphy, Saoirse Ronan, Colin Farrell, all of the rest of it, that it might be pixels or, you know, they use some image of theirs and they use that then to create a performance, and even the dialogue can be used from recordings of their voices from situation.
I would just like to inform listeners that if they think that the animation is there to replicate the human face, auto-tuning back in the 90s tried to correct the human voice and it failed utterly. And the ear becomes accustomed to the auto-tuning, so our eye would be... But I'm glad you mentioned AI because it's all about animation. The biggest animation studio in the world is Disney. But Disney went through a huge crisis in the late 1930s. In 1933, he decided for the very, very first time to make his first animation feature film. He had huge success making short films. And so he plowed an enormous amount of investment and 4 years into making his first animation feature film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. But he was hit a financial difficulty and he struck a deal with the animators. Please forego your wages and I will pay you a cut of the take, not the profits, the take, the box office take. The movies released in 1937 became one of the biggest hits of the decade. 4 years later, he had yet to pay the workers. They went out on strike and he branded them all as communists. And Franklin D. Roosevelt himself had to intervene. So I think the streaming service and the strikes here is going to be long term.
Let's have a quick listen to a clip from A Bug's Life and another another industrial relations. The ant colony is being exploited by a gang of grasshoppers into giving up grain.
Let this be a lesson to all you ants. Ideas are very dangerous things. You are mindless, soil-shoving losers. Put on this earth to serve us.
You're wrong, Hopper. Ants are not meant to serve grasshoppers. I've seen these ants do great things. And year after year, they somehow manage to pick food for themselves and you. So who is the weaker species? Ants don't serve grasshoppers. It's you who need us. We're a lot stronger than you say we are. And you know it, don't you?
Voices of Kevin Spacey and Dave Foley there in A Bug's Life. So briefly and finally then, Stephen Benedict, this current strike is about workers' rights. It's about the ants not being exploited by the grasshoppers in some ways. It's the same story.
Yeah, it's like musicians. I mean, a musician writes a piece of music and it's every time it's played on the radio, they get a royalty. If an actor or a writer is not paid from residuals and their livelihood is stripped away. And it's not only writers that will go. It'll be accountants, it'll be lawyers, it'll be financiers, it'll be agents, it'll be publicists. All that industry is swept away.
Industry.
So without being too dramatic, the battle for the future is tonight.
Well, there you go. That's your statement for the workers of SAG and other guilds along the way. That's Stephen Benedict. And that is our lot for this Monday evening here on Arena. Paula Shields and Amandine Passodivine were the researchers. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Harry Buckless was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Keshi. Back with you tomorrow night, 6:30. And John Creedon will be with you in just a few seconds' time.